I'd like to read from Swami Ram Dass in the Vision magazine, entitled Karma Yoga and Karma Sannyasa. When a sadhaka devotes his entire life to God realization, he turns away from the world of his old association. He is seized by a spirit of renunciation. He puts on orange-colored clothes, that is, assumes sannyas. The orange robe helps the sannyasin in two ways. When he takes to a wandering life and has to live on alms, the garb enables those who would feed and clothe him to know that the sadhu lives only for the doing sadhana, to attain God. The garua is really a spiritual mendicant's garb. Secondly, the colored cloth also reminds the sadhaka every movement, that is, his life, has been totally surrendered up to God, and that no unholy thoughts should dwell in his mind, and no tainted action should be done by him. This was how the cloth was helpful to Ram Dass in his itinerant life, and this was also how it reacted on his mind. It cannot be gainsaid, however, that there is great danger also in putting on the robes of sannyas. The person who wears the garua is looking upon the layman as a great saint, and he is treated with considerable respect and reverence. The result is that the sannyasi begins to feel that he belongs to a higher order of beings. Then he puts on airs and thinks himself to be superior to others. In many cases, Ram Dass has noticed that a sannyasi wants to be respected and treated by others in a special manner. Such a distorted and unhealthy influence of the cloth, while one is still in the stage of sadhaka, prevents him from making any progress on the spiritual path. His ego gets bloated day after day, and his sadhana either gets slowed down or is entirely given up. Eventually, the person turns to be a bogus sannyasi and brings disgrace to the cloth he wears, a cloth which was and has been worn by great illumined and world-renowned saints and sages like Sri Shankaracharya, Ramanujacharya, Vivekananda, Swami Ramatirtha, and others. Very often we find the same thing, which is the cause of one's liberation, acts also as a force that hurls one into worse bondage. So those who wear the sannyasin's robe should be aware of abusing its sanctity. They must live up to the ideal which it symbolizes and which is an insistent reminder. As for Ram Dass in the later stages, finding that the orange-colored cloth was proving to be an obstacle to his attainment to the all-comprehensive spiritual perfection, that is, a state of karma yoga, as distinguished by the Gita, from karma sannyasa, God divested him of the orange-colored cloth and gave him the white cloth in return, so that he can move freely amongst all people, from the highest to the lowest, without either feeling a sense of superiority himself or causing them the least embarrassment. He can now, like a child, freely move and mingle with all friends and devotees of either sex. This is a privilege he prizes more than the greatest honor or reverence he might receive from the world. Karma sannyasa implies rejection of the world as maya, an illusion. God is taken to be the sannyasi, to be only silent, immutable, and impersonal reality. The karma yogi, however, besides knowing this, also holds that the world is an expression of God, that like all beings are his forms, and all activities are his lila. While, therefore, the first is a partial spiritual experience, the latter is decidedly the complete integral realization. Been thinking about the foundation stones for a spiritual life. It seems to me that when we learn any kind of craft or any kind of skill, we start off with learning some basic foundation stones. But if we really get very good at that craft or that skill, those foundation stones are the things we always return to, always go back to. It's as if when a house is being built, or a large building. In the city that I come from, Seattle, they've been putting up large buildings all over the place. So when they start, they dig a big hole in the ground. It seems like they take months and months working on that foundation before anything else takes shape, and you wonder if anything's going on at all. Suddenly the superstructure takes up, and within days it goes up 10 or 20 or 30 stories high. So the foundation is so important. The stones that we place into the ground have to be on solid bedrock. And if they're not, then everything else that's built on top of that will be rickety and likely to fall over. So the first storm or the first flood that comes along, everything is swept away. So if we are to build a spiritual foundation, a spiritual life, this is a solid foundation, then we have to begin to think about what are those foundational stones. One is this idea that when we enter into this life, we not take on any pride. As Papa Ram Dass talked about here, if you wear special clothing, even as I am tonight, and there's that risk of having pride over that. I think all the great spiritual masters say that if you are to be a leader, then be a servant to all. In many minds, that may seem like a put-down, being a servant of somebody else. But when you see that you are a servant of God, then you see every person that you meet as God in human form. They come to your home, and as Minnie did the other day so beautifully, just served in all the different ways when I came for lunch there, and it felt as if the guests were God. And truly, wherever I come here, each place has treated me in the same way. If we treat every person that way without distinction, look for the light within them, serve that light, I think that Mother Teresa of Calcutta was a great example of that. She looked to serve the Christ within every person that she met. And it didn't make any difference of what religion they came from or what caste system they came from. None of that made any difference to her at all. She picked these dying people up out of the streets and took them to her mission and tried to give them a comfortable place to stay and clean clothes and dress their wounds and did the best that she could to give them respect above all other things. You know, the way that we treat people is so important. Jesus said that there's two great commandments. One is to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, mind, strength, and soul. The second is like unto it, love thy neighbor as thyself. If you say that you love God, but you do not love people, then you do not truly love God. In order to truly love people, we must see the light of God within them. We have to transcend the mask that people wear. Some people wear very unlovely masks, and it's difficult to see behind the mask. And we see them, and perhaps they're filled with anger, and we get filled with anger. Or they're very sad and depressed all the time, and grumbling about life. And as we're with them, we too start to feel the same way. So our moods start to reflect the moods of the people that we meet. That's not freedom. That's being enslaved by another person. If that person is angry, why are we called upon to get angry in return? Rather, if we treat that individual with respect, by first of all treating ourselves with respect. What do I mean by that? When we put ourselves down, when we see ourselves as being vulnerable to other people, we're not giving ourselves the full respect of God within us. When we feel that respect, when we feel that light within us, we feel as if we have the same right to walk this earth as any other person. That we can stand face to face with any other person on equal terms. not one down, not one up, but equally, and we deal with them from that standpoint. When we see that the light of God is burning within that one, we know, maybe only by theory at first, that that person could not live, could not have intelligence, could not move about in this world if God were not constantly giving them the ability to do that. And so if the sun rises on the just and the unjust, then we too must let the light within our own being shine out to other people. It's not to say that we become a doormat, that we allow people to run over the top of us. That's not showing respect for the light and for God in here. But the way that we speak with people, so oftentimes we hear how one person speaks to another, and it's with put-downs, and it's with derogatory comments. And they're sometimes very overt, sometimes just under the surface, but they're always there. We're not treating that person with respect. And we may even justify it. Well, they're not a very good person. They haven't measured up to what I wanted them to be, so I'm going to punish them for this. There's something called, something in marriage called normal marriage sadism. And sadism is punishment, and it's when we withhold from the other person. You didn't do just the way that I wanted you to do. You didn't act the way that I wanted you to act. Therefore, I'm going to withhold from you. I'm not going to give the things that I know make you happy because you somehow didn't meet my expectations. The other person then responds to that. They feel that withdrawal, so they too begin to withdraw. And after a while, there's no love, there's no warmth, there's no light, there's just a great chasm that exists between two people. And this is not the intention of marriage. Marriage is intended to bring people closer together. True enough, we have our rough edges, and we rub those edges against each other, and sometimes that's difficult. But we have to work through the feelings that come to us when we do that. Otherwise, we put ourselves into a period of isolation. And after a while, we look around and think, why am I even married? There is no connection here. There's no love here. There's no respect here. So first we must start with respect. To treat ourselves with respect, that we have the light of God shining within us, and then to treat the other person with respect, that they too deserve that. And as I say, at first it may be only in theory, because we don't experience the light within them. But as we concentrate on that, and we cultivate that attitude, gradually we come to see that that too has the light within them. And we can come to love them, perhaps in spite of the frailties or the faults that we see within them. If we carry anger, if we carry rejection towards another person, who's doing the caring? I am, if I'm the one who's holding that. I'm the one who's really cutting myself off from my own joy, from my own happiness. I don't feel it because I'm withholding it from another. Now, when we do for another, it's not just out of doing it to make them happy. It's because that gives us joy. When we get into the right spirit of this, when we serve another person, it's not because, oh, I hope that makes you happy. This makes me joyful in order to serve. I serve out of that love. I serve out of that joy. And it's a completely different place to do actions from. It's not dependent on what the other person does. Do they give back to us or not? Do they do for us what we hope that they would? It's not dependent on that. We give to them. And when we give in that selfless way, we feel the joy in the giving. Now, this is very different than what the world would have us know, which is, if you are nice to me, I'll be nice to you. If you do for me, I'll do for you. If you don't do for me, forget it. you're out. You know? And there's this invisible ledger sheet up here in the sky, right? And you get 1 point, okay, I'll give you 1 point over there. And down the ledger it goes. And some people keep those ledgers very carefully. 10 years ago, you didn't do this thing. I was talking to somebody the other day, and they had her mother and her aunt hadn't spoken to each other for 28 years. Why? Because when they're at the wedding, the one aunt didn't come over to the other aunt at the right time and say hello to her. All right, you're out. And for 28 years, they haven't spoken to each other. And so it just becomes something that carries a weight of its own and doesn't ever stop. Now, I say it doesn't make us a doormat, because when somebody treats us with disrespect, we can ask for, we can demand that respect be there. We say, no, that's not right. You shouldn't treat me that way. But when we enter into that, we have to let go of even the result of that. That person may not change. They may not do things differently. And if they don't, then we're given a choice. Do we withdraw from relationship, or do we continue with relationship and serve in a selfless way? I think it depends on the agreement that we make in the beginning. If we make agreement to, we are in this for long term, then we try to hold to that agreement all the way through. If it's somebody who's a casual friend and they don't treat us well, no reason for us to have to put up with that. You know, there's no agreement there to go forward like that. So it depends on the agreement that we make with that individual. And agreements are very, very important. I think today we take agreements far too lightly. When we enter into a relationship with someone, we start to make agreements with them from the very beginning. How will we speak to each other? When we say we'll be at a certain place at a certain time, does that actually happen or not? Do we say that we're going to do something and then we consistently don't do it? We need to examine ourselves and see that when we make agreements, that we bend every effort to make those agreements. And then, if for some reason we can't make an agreement, but we've had a long history of making agreements, that can usually be forgiven. It's a little bit like a bank account. If you are always putting in deposits and doing kind things for another person and going out of your way for that person, every time that's a deposit. If angry words are said or something derogatory is said, that's a withdrawal from the bank account. And pretty soon we find, do we have a lot of savings in there, you know, and a lot of good things stored up? And if so, well, if a few, one or two things go wrong, now those things can be forgiven easily. But if we only take withdrawals, and then suddenly there's a huge debt there, and then we do something wrong, that may be it, we're bankrupt. No more, I'm not going to do this any longer. So to make an agreement and to stay with that agreement is very important in relationships and in respect with ourselves and for another person. So this karma yoga, this karma is action, yoga is union. So one attitude is I'm serving the light within another person. But there is a step that goes beyond that, and that is where I feel that it is the divine essence that is flowing through me, that moves through this body, through deepened meditation and devotion, I start to feel that I'm in intimate communion with the spiritual essence. I don't feel that it's just this little human self and this little human ego that's operating. Rather, there's a divine presence that is within me, and I can feel it flowing through the life force that fills up this body. I feel it flowing through the intelligence and the thoughts that I think. I feel it flowing through the words that I speak. Every part of me seems to be an instrument for this divine intelligence. Now, to some, that may seem like a fantasy, or something that's unattainable that only a few may have, but not all. But I tell you, we are all designed to be instruments for divine consciousness. And if we would but know it, we could not move or breathe or think or have our being if it were not for that divine intelligence already flowing through us. So it's not such a matter as, is it flowing through me? Is it, do I realize that it's flowing through me? And what happens when I come into conscious connection with the idea that this divine essence is flowing through me? I feel a peace right in the center of my being. I feel a joy that spontaneously comes up through my being. I feel guided through the intelligence, through the things that I do and that I say. I feel a vibration emanating in me and radiating out from me. And when we come into contact with that divine essence, in the beginning it may be just little tiny glimpses. Sometime I am doing something and I'm just totally in the joy of the doing. And I feel the purity of that expression. But as my practice deepens, I can have that as longer and longer windows of experience until I feel that that whole divine essence has taken over my being. My old self, the way that I used to think, the way that I used to perceive this world, the way that I used to exist in this world, begins to dissipate. And then only this sense of oneness is there. And this is the ultimate aim of human evolution, is to evolve into divine consciousness. When we do that, we free ourselves from the world of cause and effect. No longer am I looking, does this person respond to everything that I do? And so I give as I am given to. But rather, I give because it's a spontaneous motion that comes out of me. When the rose exudes a fragrance, it doesn't think, oh, is this person worthy of my fragrance here? And if they're not worthy, I'm gonna withhold it. Oh, here's a nice person coming. I'll exude my fragrance now. No, the rose exudes the fragrance because that's its nature. And it gives it to one and all. And when we experience this divine essence within ourselves, it begins to exude this sweet fragrance of spirit that comes out of us. Now, sometimes people get so focused on the words, on the law of religious practice. And when they do that to the exclusion of the spirit, of the sweetness of that fragrance, they are misusing that spiritual text. Because all spiritual texts, all saints, all sages are pointing to the one same goal. And that is to experience this divine God intoxication, to be lifted up in this presence, to know our nature as a spiritual nature. It is not to confine us into a lot of rules and regulations that confine the life but offer no freedom. The intention is to bring us into our freedom. Give me a discipline that will lead me to my freedom, not into bondage. And so true saints, true masters, true scriptures will be always focusing our attention not toward a discipline that leads us into bondage, but a discipline that lifts up the mind, that gives us sweetness and fragrance of divine presence. And when we have that, and we act, and we move, and we think in that, that is karma yoga, that is union while in action. And that is a marvelous state to be in. And it frees us. It frees us. We no longer have that invisible ledger book where we're keeping score all the time. but rather we act out of that divine consciousness. We are always feeling that divine presence, and it moves through us, it thinks through us, it acts through us, and we come into true and complete freedom, liberation, because we are no longer bound by cause and effect. We are only involved in cause as it flows through us. So I'm just going to stop there and see if there's any questions about this idea of karma yoga that touches each one of our lives. You know, as long as we breathe, as long as we eat, we're in action. So there's no avoiding it. In the beginning of the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna wants to quit the battlefield. Says, this is difficult. Wouldn't it be better just to go to meditate in a cave? And Arjuna says, no such luck. Stay on the battlefield. It's the battlefield of life. And sometimes we think, oh, maybe I'll lead a spiritual life, you know, when my children are gone and when I don't have to work so hard and later on, and then I'll lead a spiritual life. But I say, your life is your temple. Your children, your wives, your husbands, your work, everything is part of your spiritual life. That is your sadhana. You don't have to travel to distant places, or you don't have to leave the home and the hearth in order to practice this inward discipline. It is right where you're at. And so to recognize that is a great blessing. And suddenly, the dilemmas that we find ourselves in, here's a difficult personality, or here's a difficult situation in my life. And instead of personalizing it and saying, why don't they act better? And get involved in the drama of what they ought to be doing, instead of focused here, say, ah, this is God come to me in this form, and he's testing me. He's giving me this form to see whether I can see through the mask or not. And if I can successfully pierce that veil of the mask, then I can see God residing, and love and joy spontaneously flow out of me. And so I'm not bound by the old human interactions, cause and effect that goes on in that way. Rather, I get more involved in, who am I in all of this? What do I have to learn? How can I be more in this selfless service so that I can find my freedom? And coincidentally, it makes us more effective. You know, if you think of taking on a large project, and you think of starting that project, and you're really focused on the goal. Now, every project that we start with has a goal, has an end in mind. That's natural. But if we get consumed with what the end product looks like, as soon as we get started, we start judging ourselves or the project. Oh, this isn't looking the way that I want it to look. It's not going to be as nice as I want it to be. It's not going the direction that I want it to go, because I'm so fixated on the goal, I'm not being present with how this project is unfolding. I'm not feeling any joy in it. If you've ever driven someplace and you've been in such a hurry to get there, and you're weaving in and out of traffic, and you're going as fast as you can, you're having no joy in that, unless you enjoy racing cars a lot. But you're so intent on the end, you have no joy in the travel at all. You don't notice anything. But when you travel, and part of it is taking the trip, that's part of the joy. When you start a project, if you're feeling the flow, oh, I'm going to move into this project now. I'm making an agreement with myself or maybe some other people, and I'm very intentionally moving myself into this project. That's a very different way of handling it. very different way. Swami Satchidananda said, you know, when many worldly people, how they do something is like that. He says, when you're doing something for God, you do it like this. See? Small difference, but it's the attitude, it's the intention that we do it with. He gave the example of somebody trying to meditate, and one day they're meditating and somebody knocked on the door. Who's disturbing my meditation? Don't they know I'm trying to meditate? How dare they do that? And they charge to the door and say, what are you doing disturbing me like this? Well, I was just wondering, don't you not know not to disturb me? And slam the door. Do you think they could go back and sit down and meditate peacefully? You know, they're all disturbed and everything. But second example, somebody sitting down to meditate. Ah, God has come to the door, has something for me to do. Answer the door, yes. Well, I want something from you. All right. And you go and you take care of it, and you do it in the right attitude, and then you come back, you sit down, you're at peace, you can continue to meditate. In fact, the whole action has been a meditation. So there's no break. You conduct your life as if you are in the flow of this divine presence, this divine consciousness. And if you do that, you will find such great freedom, such great joy, such great bliss, and life is fun. Fun. Oftentimes fun isn't connected with God. You know, God demands this discipline, demands this sadhana. But it's true, God has a great sense of humor. The fact that he created us, I think, is proof that he has a great sense of humor. So he has to have a great sense of humor. And he is fun. And he is joy. Not at somebody else's expense, but it's just spontaneous. It erupts in us. It continues to move through us in a bubbling manner. And so you see, that's not known about too much. But it's true. It's true. So all these teachings should be very practical. Things you can take to your life and start to apply. And really, it's a science. And what is science? Science starts out with a hypothesis. I postulate this is true. And that if you do A, B, and C, this will be the result. And so if we treat this as a science, and we say, all right, here's a hypothesis. The world is God. And I start to treat people and all situations as God in human form, as God in this world. Will I experience more freedom? Will I experience more joy? Or on the other side, if I continue to kind of treat everything as personal and keep this ledger sheet, do I notice that that encapsulates me, that enslaves me to this ledger system? And so treat it as a science. Notice what the results are as you do this. Don't accept it because I say it or because somebody else says it, but prove it for yourself. And if you will do these things, I think that your life will improve. I think that you will have more joy. But you need to prove it. And you can only do that by putting it into practice. So to experience life in this way means great joy, means your freedom. So I postulate. Up to all of us to prove it. Fortunately, it's not only me that's postulated that. All the great saints, all the great sages have said the same thing. So are there any questions about anything we talked about last night or tonight? Or just about your own sadhana and journey? You know, sometimes people are a little hesitant to say things. Well, I don't know if I want to say that in front of other people. But I would wager if you say it, other people have been thinking it. You've just been the one brave enough to say it.
How do you pray?
Mm. Yeah. God's been showing me something very interesting. It's not a brand new idea to me, but it's taken me very much deeper into the understanding of it. But that when we pray, we don't pray to change God. You know, God, give me this. God, make sure this happens over here. That what I've been shown is that grace is constantly around us. We're swimming in grace. The grace to change, the grace to have this upliftment and this purity of spirit. Only we've built a shell around ourselves that keeps that grace from coming out. Now that sounds crazy on the surface. Why would I keep out my good? Fact is, we do it all the time. So we don't pray to change God. God's grace is always there. But we pray in order to change ourselves, to create an opening by which grace may come in. Two football teams about to take the field. On one side, somebody is kneeling down to say a prayer. God, help me to win the game today. On the other side, somebody else is kneeling down. God, help me to win the game today. Who's God going to choose? Is he going to choose one or the other? He says, well, I think you've been a little better today, so your team gets to win. You know, that's not how it operates. It's, God, make me an instrument of your grace, of your power, of your speed, of make me play the best game that I can possibly play. And then we open ourselves not just to our own resources as a human being, but to all the divine consciousness that can flow through us. So we do it to open a channel through which God may operate through us. Because our thoughts, our attitudes, the way we've constructed ourselves, tends to block out that grace. So in sincerity, since we're really trying to change ourselves, it is what touches our own heart. Now, some people have formula of prayer, and you pray in this way. And other people pray like a child, just having a conversation. I have different forms of prayer. Some, we did the opening prayer today, and to me, that's very beautiful, and I've repeated it many, many times. And as I do it, I try to keep my full attention on that prayer and the meaning of the prayer. And so it deepens for me. And so I think that kind of prayer has a great value. But there are other times when I just want to talk to God. And I say, God, this is what's gone on in my day today. And I just want to talk it over with you. And I'd like you to show me how to do this better, or I'd like to just share this moment. It's like a friendship in many ways. I want to share this with you. And I feel the close communion as I would with a deep friend. And so all the different personalities that we have may have a different means of prayer. Sometimes we may be angry. Now some people think of their anger, oh, I don't want to be angry with God. But if we think about it, if we're not bringing our anger to God, we're withholding it from Him. Now, God has big shoulders. Big shoulders. He can take it. And so, if we give Him our anger, if we give Him our frustration, if we give Him our hurt, our disappointment, God, I thought my life would turn out better. Or when I was a child, this terrible thing happened to me. How could you allow that to happen? I just feel such hurt, such betrayal around that. And to take all of those normal human feelings and emotions to God and give them to Him. Give them to Him. And when we do, we create an opening for grace to come into us. And if we close ourselves off to that and refuse to give that to God, oh no, I couldn't do that, then we close ourselves off to grace. We don't want to be disrespectful, but we're also saying, Well, I can't do that. You know, if you have a very good friend and something happens, some misunderstanding, and you feel angry with them, oh, I'm not going to talk to them about it. I'm not going to say anything about it. A little wall goes up. And if we put a lot of deposits into that bank account, maybe that's okay. But if we hold several of those, pretty soon those each become a bigger brick in the wall, and pretty soon there's a very thick wall there. Oh, I can't get angry with my friend. I couldn't ever say to my mother, you know, when you said this, it made me feel really hurt and angry, because that would be disrespectful to my mother. But it begins to create a division. And with each time that we do that, it creates a greater and greater divide. Now, some people may not be, you know, we may not be invested enough in the relationship to say, to kind of deepen it in that way. They may not be of the mind that it's safe enough to approach them with that. And so we say, all right, it's better to have that distance then. That person's not safe. But if we treat God that way, that it's not safe to come to God with that hurt, with that anger, that's not being fair to God, because that's saying, I don't think you can handle it. But if God can't handle it, who can? So by opening ourselves, it creates a channel which grace might come back to us. So what appeals to the heart, what appeals to your whole soul, what appeals to your mood in that way, and create an opening for grace to come to you, whatever that is. And that will change from day to day, even from moment to moment. But we make God a full-fledged partner in our life, not just once on Sunday kind of partner, but a full-fledged partner, intimate, in our life, and always there. Does that make sense or answer the question? Yeah. It was really interesting when it came to me that it's not about changing God, it's about changing ourselves. Because if a nation says, God, help me to win this war, and they don't win the war, what did God say? No, I'm not going to help you. Is that how it works? But I think if we're clear and clean with God, if we're straight with God, then we'll be in the right place at the right time. Doesn't mean that everything in the world goes right. And from a human perspective, let's say that there is an athlete who gets injured in his college career, but he's also a medical student. Now, his plans was to go on and become a professional athlete, but he got short-circuited through that injury. He dedicates himself to his studies, and he becomes a doctor. And by becoming a doctor, he helps all those people he was intended to help. Now, he may feel very disappointed, very sad at getting that injury, but it's working for a higher good that that happened. And if we could but see it, we would see that everything that happens in our life works for a higher good, even though the outward results don't appear to be that way. There was once a man in a small village, and he was very devout, and he said, everything happens by the will of God. So one day, his son came down with a very bad disease, and so they had to send him away to another village. And then the man's chickens all got a disease, and they all got killed, and they died off. And then somebody came along, and somebody stole his cow. And every time he said, everything happens by the will of God. But the neighbors were going, what? Your son is injured, he got sent away, your chickens are all dead, your cow is taken away. How is that good for you? Well, the next day, This prince came through with a large army, and he is wiping out everything as he went along, killing everyone. And he went to this village, and he found everybody, and he killed everyone. But he came to this man's house. The man and his wife were hiding in the hut. The prince looked around. He says, "There's no cow. There's no chickens. I don't see any young people here. I don't think anybody lives here. Let's move on." And he moved on, and the trouble passed. So we can't tell when disaster visits us. From a human standpoint, it feels like disaster. From a divine standpoint, it can be working for our highest good. We don't know because we see life from a very narrow vision. So we don't know all the ways that this may be working for our good. Tenacious.
It's me in so much trouble. If I need to bring something before God so I can find a resonance in myself, how do I know that I'm achieving a balance to what is more true than what is more or academically, intellectually true?
That's a great question, because when we're in a state of ignorance, how do we judge what is true? If we've admitted by virtue of we have limited means of knowing what is true. But there are some hallmarks that ring true when we're getting true direction inside. One is we feel at peace. We don't feel like we're reacting out of fear. We don't feel like we're reacting out of greed, or out of lust, or out of anger. We feel this movement coming from a place of peace inside of us. We feel a sense of purity. We don't feel that what we're entering into is kind of dirty or solid or taking us away from the light. If we can imagine the saints all standing around us, and we feel all right about doing what we're doing, then that's a good sign that we're on the right track. If we were being shown on television all over the world, and we feel, this is all right what I'm doing, then that's a good sign. But if we feel, oh, no, I wouldn't want anybody else to know about this. I don't feel good if all the saints knew and saw me doing this. So those are good signals as to whether we're on the right track or not. As we deepen in our realization, our ability to discern truth becomes stronger. It is guided by an inner divine intelligence. Jesus said, "I don't judge, but if I judge, my judgment is true." Now, is that a contradiction in the one he says, "I don't judge"? It's because the divine intelligence within him, as a human being, he doesn't judge people. But when that divine intelligence says, "This is true," he knows that it's true. And the same is true with all of us, that with our human reason, we do the best that we can. But when we get quiet inside, it puts us in touch with this divine intelligence. And we feel the rightness of it. We feel the truth of it. It's not built on narrow sectarianism. It's not built on hatred. It's not built on greed, all of those things. Those are the foundations for how the human mind works. The divine mind works completely independent of those. So we look to the qualities. What do I experience? So I have that. Do I feel at peace with that? Do I feel at ease? Do I feel right about that? If I were to ask God or the spiritual masters or the gurus or the saints, is this right? Would I feel their assent? Would I feel their yes?
What about sometimes you look at something that I need to make a and I feel that there's a little voice already giving me an answer and I'm going against it.
So the thing to do then, and this is where meditation comes in, really, the more that we enter into that silence and that stillness, we get quiet with it. We ask the question, if we're faced with making a decision about something, and so we ask the question, what is the right thing to do here? And we ask God, we ask the light, we ask that purity about it. And then we get quiet. We don't get busy thinking about it. The mind can just get on a track that just takes us around in a circle and around. Well, on this hand, this sounds good, and on this hand, this sounds good. And on this hand, this is a problem, and on this hand, this is a problem. And around and around and around we go, and no answer. So instead of using the intellect, which is limited in its reasoning ability, you know, there's this theory in physics that somebody worked out a mathematical model that if a butterfly flapped its wings in Africa, which startled a bird, which startled a flock of birds, which started a herd to run off, and they built this mathematical model where it actually changed the weather in North America.
Okay.
That's how complex and interrelated the world is. So if you don't like the rainy weather here, talk to the butterflies in Africa. But that's, how can the human intellect, how could we possibly know what is the right thing to do? What's going to be for the highest good of everybody? The intellect could never take in that much information.
But couldn't you find yourself in a position where you might lull yourself into going, oh, gee, that's the answer.
Of course. But that's where our integrity comes in. When we get still and we ask the divine intelligence by definition is in oneness with all the world. And so knows all the ins and the outs. It is in intimate knowledge of all of that. So it's only through divine intelligence that we can make correct movement in the world, make correct decisions. So to get into tune with that divine intelligence is to ask the question and then get still. Not let the intellect die down. Let the body get quiet and listen. You know, they say that prayer without meditation is like asking a question without waiting for an answer. Prayer without meditation is like asking a question without waiting for an answer. We're always talking, we're never listening. Meditation is listening, it's getting quiet. And so we learn to still ourselves. So we ask the question, and then we get quiet, and we wait. Now in my case, sometimes the answers came in a moment, and I knew. And you get accustomed to that sense of knowing. Sometimes it's been days, or weeks, or months, or even years, where I've asked a question before the answer comes back to me. Now, I don't think that that's God withholding the information from me. It's my ability to be able to listen carefully enough, to be open to what that answer is, to be sensitive enough, to be receptive. So it's like trying to find a radio station. And we dial in and dial in and dial in, and we get static, 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 and suddenly we get a radio station we've been looking for. And it's like that with God. We dial ourselves in, we attune ourselves, and then we get on frequency. And then we get that alignment, and then sometimes we drift off, and then we bring ourselves back. That getting quiet, that getting still, is bringing ourselves into the right attunement with that divine intelligence. When we do, we feel that unity, we feel that purity. Now we may make a mistake. Say, oh, I think I'm being guided to do this. And so we start moving down that road. But as we do, something in here starts, this isn't right. I don't feel right about doing this. I thought this was the right direction, but the further I go down here, I get this kind of soul sickness in my stomach, my solar plexus. I really, no, this isn't right. And so then we stop. We go back to the original question. We get still again. We ask the question, and we wait in quietness for the answer to come. Answer is already there. We're not listening. We're so busy in the mind, we're so attached to things in the mind, we don't want to hear the answer.
You're not a quitter.
Right.
It's just all of a sudden you can't ignore the walls vibrating and the trees screaming and the rocks flying. It's like,
why not?
You have to stop.
Why not? If it is your true inner direction, what does it matter if you die? If you're following that direction, your mind is on God. Let's take the contrasting. You ignore that. You say the cost is too high. I'm not going to do that. You take your...
listening at the beginning when he said, oh, sure, I'll go do that.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's our integrity. That's where we... That's where we have to get still.
Because I'll commit myself to something.
Mm. Happens all the time.
Then all of a sudden I'm beginning the execution of the commitment and this isn't right.
That's why we need to check in before we make the commitment. Yes.
When I do that.
By going through pain, time after time after time, and making the wrong decisions, and finally say, enough. I'm not going to go through this pain any longer. I'm going to start communing, doing this inner communion with God before I make decisions.
Hello, I have to get back to you tomorrow.
Yes.
Right.
Buy yourself some time.
Then you get known as the person who can never make a decision.
No, that's not true, because when you make the decision, you make a true agreement. You are 100% there. So you get known as somebody who, when you make an agreement, you make it 100%. So that's what you get known for. Versus somebody who makes two quick agreements and then suddenly, oh, I don't think I like this. And you start to withdraw from it. I'd much rather be known for somebody who moves a little slower into it, but once I'm there, I'm all the way there.
It's okay to like get maybe halfway through life and decide you don't want to be known for quick decisions.
Of course.
And not fall. Oh no.
Of course. Yes. If we can't, if we can't allow ourselves to change.
It's a hard pattern to break.
It is. But how much pain do we want to go through doing it the other way? This is very practical. Just a very practical example. Before I would buy something that wasn't a necessity, I gave myself a 24-hour rule. I'd see something in the store. Yes, I think I want to get that. I'm going to wait one day. Overnight and clear the next day till 24 hours on the clock. It's amazing how many times at that time in my life, 24 hours would go by, you know, I really don't need that.
That's easy to do. Well, pardon me. I find that one actually quite easy to do.
Very nice.
But important kinds of things.
Every one of us have our points. But remember what I said earlier about your life is your sadhana. Your life is your spiritual path. This is your spiritual path. This is your spiritual awakening. There are no small things. This is where your whole focus of attention comes to. I want to change this. Be because it's important. It reflects the light within me. It opens a brand new channel for the light to express itself through me. So it's not small. And sometimes people say, oh, it's just a small problem. Oftentimes it's not, because it represents something much larger. So we really start to pay attention to decisions that we make. Where we place our mind at, what we choose to do, becomes much more important because we start to see they have consequences. They matter. Our life matters. And if we say, oh, who cares? You know, we'll care eventually because it catches up with us. Person who abuses their health all their life, they seem to get away with it. They have great health, but that will follow along with them, and they'll have difficulties in other lifetimes. Sometimes somebody has wonderful health habits, and they suffer and they suffer and they suffer. And it's because those things are still moving along with them. And they say, why? I seem to be following good health habits, but I only have problems. And it's because those consequences are still playing themselves out. So it does matter what we do, even when we don't think that it matters. There's a saying that ignorance of the law is not an excuse. And that's true with karma also. Ignorance that it matters is not an excuse. So it's by doing things and then seeing the results that we learn. And we keep facing those results and facing those results. And when we don't like those results, we say, I need to change this. This is too hard. This is too painful. And then when we see ourselves making decisions and getting good results from that, we go, ah, I'm on the right track now. Let's keep doing more of this. So it's important what we do. It's important what we think. It's important what we say. You know, when we speak unkind words to another person, that's an injury that goes in. That's a wound. And eventually, that comes back to us. So it's important what we do. It really is. And we act as if it isn't. It's just how I felt in the moment. Who cares?
So what happens if, this nice little path, and you go, gee, I'm working at trying to be a better, kinder, softer person, but people are still standing on the side of the road throwing rocks at me. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then I look in the mirror and I go, oh my goodness, this is my bill for my last lifetime.
Uh-huh.
Okay, you can't go to God and say, okay, I got the picture, right, so he cuts the debt.
Uh-huh.
I can accept that. But can you reduce that big karma bill that you've got? It's not like to say, you go, oh gee, maybe I've got 20 more years to live, so I can sort of like hang out and just be really, you know, it doesn't have to matter.
Mm-hmm.
And in 19 years and 11 months and 27 days, I'll just sort of like go, oh, okay, God, I got the picture. No, that's not the thing, but like,
grace,
be able to redeem.
Grace is there. So that when you turn your attention back toward the One, back toward the light, then you can start experiencing peace. You can start experiencing joy. When I was very ill one time and I had high temperature for about 6 days, and while body was in a lot of pain, and as I kept my mind on God and giving him all of this, in my inner vision, I saw Swami Ramdas up there. And he just had a big smile on his face. And so in my mind's eye, I came up and we started dancing around and around in a circle. And I felt such joy. And in the midst of, even while my body was still feeling pain and this fever was burning up my body, I was dancing in joy. In that way, we may still get the effects of something that we've done, but we also feel an inner sense of peace. We feel an inner sense of joy. Might compare it to if you have a credit card and you go out and you run up a lot of debt, and it's a lot of fun at first. You're getting things, you're doing things, everything seems so lovely. And then you start getting more and more uneasy, you know? This credit card bill is going to come due. I'm going to have to pay it. And that's going to take a dent out of things, money that I'm making. And so that sense of uneasiness begins to grow and grow and grow. And finally say, I've got to stop this. This is a terrible habit. So you stop spending the money and you start paying off the money. Now, in an outward sense, it looks like you have less. You're not able to go out and just get things. But you feel right about it. You feel good about it. That feeling of being uneasy about the whole thing. Okay, I'm on the right track now. I feel in alignment with myself. So you're still having to pay off the debt, but you feel right about yourself. You feel right about your life. And that's the grace that comes in. You still may get the effects, but you get the grace that helps you to work through it and do it in a good way.
What is kriya? I was asked that today. Could you tell us what kriya yoga is?
Well, I can explain some things about it. Kriya yoga is one of those things that's given in initiation, and when we were talking about agreements, that represents an agreement between student and teacher that says, I'm going to follow this path. And teacher makes an agreement that commits themselves to be there for the student. But kriya is a way of quickening our growth in consciousness. When we start to rise up in consciousness, these higher centers in the chakras begin to open up. We can consciously quicken that process by moving the life force and revolving it around the spine and the brain. We do it through breath, we do it through visualizing the course of that energy and that breath and coordinating those two things. When we visualize something or we see it, we move life energy to it. You may not be very aware of your right toe right now until I just mentioned it. You move your consciousness there and suddenly you become aware of it. In the same way, we can move life force within our system by focusing our attention in certain ways. And so it's learning how to circulate this life force in the spine and the brain that's designed to prepare the spine and the brain for this great awakening and brings the life force energy into it that begins it in a very natural way to begin to unfold. So we can consciously use this process to quicken our evolution in gaining our realization. There's the branch of yoga called Raja Yoga that has to do with life force and movement of life force within the body, and it is connected with the Raja Yoga, and it is this movement of this life force within the spine and the brain.
Thank you.
Master used to call the Hangsa the mini Kriya, that it has great power even though it's very simple, the Hangsa. But Kriya brings with it even more. It's the technique that Babaji taught to Lari Mahasya and that Yogananda brought to the West here. And so it's free and independent of any religion. It's a spiritual practice meant to enhance anyone in any religion that they follow. So it's not a religion in and of itself. It's not just for Hindus or just for Christians or just for Muslims. It's for anybody to take and to utilize in order to quicken their own evolution. And it's referred to by Krishna and by Christ and by many of the other great masters through time. That technique or one very similar to it. So it's a great, great gift for those who feel inwardly directed to do that. Any other questions or thoughts or comments? Do you have a question? I know you're shy, but it's all right.
If it's okay for us to come together because we're gathering for it to be in community with each other in God's spirit. And if a person doesn't feel drawn to take Kriya, we can still come together.
Oh, like
that's,
certainly.
That's okay. There's no pressure.
No.
That doesn't make us...
There's no... We have no organization. We have no name. But when we come together with the intention of putting the mind and the spirit on God and expanding that, that's always good. So there's no roles to join. There's no, it's free and it's open. I took three promises from Mother when she gave me permission to teach. One was no organization, no name, no board of directors, none of that. The other is not to advertise. So it's all by word of mouth. And the third is that not to charge for anything. So right now, people have made it possible through their donations that we can do publications and not charge. There may be a time when we need to charge, I don't know. But at least for any services that are provided, no charge for any of that. It's freely given, freely received. All I ask is that the light that is within you, you also freely give, so that others may freely receive. Nobody can corner the market on God. God cannot be bought, nor can he be sold. So no one religion, no one person has any greater claim on God than anybody else. If people feel drawn to certain teachings, they find that it's helpful in elevating their consciousness, then that's good. Then that's the way it should be. And when you find something that is right for you, then you stick with that. And that's done to avoid confusing the mind. You know, it's like when you want to go for an advanced degree. When you get an undergraduate degree, a bachelor's degree, you may study history and language and mathematics and a little bit of everything. But when you go for an advanced degree, you pick a particular subject. And if you get a PhD, you pick a particular subject within that subject. And so your attention gets more and more narrowly focused in order to take you deeper into that teaching. So if you find a teaching that appeals to you, then you go deeper and you make that commitment to go deeper into that teaching. And you don't keep spreading your energies out amongst all the different teachings. You recognize that they're all true. But for yourself, you take it deeper into one. But you find that all are kindred spirits who love God and seek to serve God. And they feel like brothers and sisters to you. They don't feel foreign to you. And that's the way that it should be. It's like growing up in your own home. You know who your mother and your father are. You may go to a friend's house, and their mother and father are very nice to you. Sometimes you may enjoy it better there than you do your own home. But you've never mistaken another's mother and father for your own. You always know who your mother and father are. And that's when we feel the rightness of a certain teaching and we get drawn to it. That becomes our heritage, our spiritual heritage. And so we always know that that's where our home is. But we can look at all the other houses of God and see there the light and the spirit that's there. But it's like the man who went to find some treasure that was 20 feet under the ground. He didn't know it was 20 feet under the ground, but he knew it was under the ground someplace. So he dug a hole that about 5 feet deep. He goes, I don't think treasure is here. He starts another hole. He goes 7 feet deep. Oh, I don't think it's here. He goes to another hole. He goes 4 feet deep. Oh, this is way too rocky. I'm going to go to another place. He starts there. He's got all these holes. If you add up the feet for all those holes, it could be hundreds of feet. But he's never gone 20 feet deep in any one place, so he never found the treasure. So if we're always here and we're always there and we're just kind of dabbling around, we never get the treasure.
That must be why they always told us to do the hard job first.
Hey? That's right.
When we were kids, do the hardest one first. The rest will all seem easy.
Well, with Mother Hamilton, who was a student of Yogananda's, and I met her in 1974, and she left the body in 1991. And so, while she was in body, that was the length of time, and then it's only continued since then. It's convinced me that death is no barrier to consciousness. Mother Hamilton.
She's in
Samadhi. Mahasamadhi. She's left the body in 1991.
So you're doing this on your own now? Nobody.
She gave me permission to teach, and so I've carried on. I had permission to initiate and teach for some time, but I didn't feel inwardly right about it, to go forward with it. And then came the inner direction. All right, now it's time. So I felt I had both God and Guru's direction to do it. It's a big commitment, because when you take on that commitment, you commit yourself to that soul. Yeah, and it's not one that I felt I could make as an individual personality. It had to be that divine intelligence making it through me. And if it wasn't that, then it's just something of the ego.
You said when you arrived at the decision to do Kriya initiation, that's a commitment to each soul that you initiate.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's not just for a week or two. Not just for this life. So only God can make that commitment.
Can you tell us how Anandashram comes into this picture a little bit.
Mother was a disciple of Yogananda's since 1925. She met him and continued with him, and he left the body in Mahasamadhi in 1952, March 7th. And after that time, he had left an organization, and they started making changes and differences. And Mother did not agree with how they changed Yogananda's words, and they even changed his signature, how he wrote his name, changed so many things, and were not always respectful of those who were following after. So she met Swami Ram Dass when he was on a world tour in 1954. And she felt the degree of realization in him that perhaps he could help her get her final realization. She had achieved high state of realization before that, but she wanted this final state of full realization. So she and her husband sold their house, cashed in their retirement, everything, and traveled to the south of India, this ashram there. Very unusual thing to do at the time. They had their picture in the paper, and they went. So they eventually ended up there, and it was there that Mother underwent these experiences that she called the mystical crucifixion. And what happened is that the scriptures of the Christian scriptures, the inner meaning began to unfold for her, and she saw that it wasn't the story of one person who lived 2,000 years ago, but it was a story of every person told in symbolic ways. That when Jesus traveled in Galilee, Galilee meant the circuit, and that was traveling up the spine. That he went to the hill of Golgotha, which meant the hill of the skulls. That means coming up into the skull in higher consciousness. And so all of these sayings had these inner meanings. And all of this was unfolded as she went through these experiences. And so she felt that she paid a price by going through these very difficult spiritual experiences in order to know this inner truth of these scriptures that all of us are familiar with. So a very great soul, and Swami Ram Dass, who was at had formed an Anandashram and was a very great God being, was the one who helped her, and she felt that if he hadn't been there, she would not have survived these experiences. So he was, his influence and his presence was very important in her ability to move through this. So we hold him in great love and reverence, and besides, he's a delightful saint. Actually, organization, while she was gone, they said, you went to India without our permission, you're out of the organization.
But Mother's relationship with Master, he had imparted to her to remain true to what he had taught her.
Yes. I made her promise to him that she would stay true to him and his teachings. And she said, even with the organization? He said, yes, even with the organization, your promises to me.
So how does Priscilla, like Amrita, come in, then, which is out of Texas, where Master's true teachings are available?
She was able to produce those works, his original lessons and books.
How was Priscilla linked at all to Mother?
Only that they communicated with each other, and she came up and visited, and
it's amazing that they were back.
They felt great kinship of spirit there.
So Mother, I think somebody has told me that Mother spent a long time in Washington State, many times before people started to come, and would be attracted to the word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why we say like attraction rather than promotion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Should we close up? Any other questions? Okay. Tomorrow night we'll also meet at the back of Constance home, and we will pick up some of the deeper meanings around some Kundalini experiences and that kind of thing, and go into some of that for next time. So you're all welcome to come. Hmm. Are you sure you didn't have a question?
Probably had a couple.
Are you coming tomorrow for lunch, Cindy?
Sorry.
It's my great joy.
I heard all what you said many times before. A lot of people, but it never helped.
Yeah.
It finally cleared as was clear as a bell. And I never heard it. It says so clear and so nicely, and with the feel of there was peace and love and the presence of God. I know that this is the right word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hot.
Om Shri Ram.